find information and see what the doc is.
All right, so thanks for the invitation and coming in. So I'm going to talk about work which was done at Yale in collaboration with Steve Gerben, and also in very close collaboration with the group of Rob Schulkopf, who realized most of the, well, all of the, obtained all the experimental results that I'll be presenting throughout the talk. So the goal here is to use electrical circuits which are made out of superconductors and use them and design them in such a way that the quantum properties become apparent, that we can probe the quantum properties. And all of these, there's different ways to build these, to design these circuits, and all of them have in common the fact that they use Josephson junctions. Josephson junctions are the basic non-linear, non-dissipative elements which makes all of that possible. And depending on the size of the junctions that one uses, from small to bigger, it's possible to encode the quantum information in these circuits, either using charge-like degree of freedom or phase-like degree of freedom in these circuits. And there have been several experiments showing quantum behavior in these circuits, and starting in 1999 with current control and charge type superconducting qubits. And more recently, we've seen first attempts at realizing two qubit gates, again, in charge qubits, actually. And all of these experiments have in common the fact that one uses a classical field to control them, a field which has several photons. And so the quantum mechanics here is really in the electrical circuit, not in the control field. But more recently, it's been realized that it should be possible to couple these electrical circuits also to a field which has a few number of photons, down to a single photon. And then quantum mechanics is important both in the electrical circuit and in the quantized electrical field. And that opens the possibility to study quantum optics now in a condensed matter setting. And this is what I'm going to talk about today. So I'll first say a few words about quantum optics, or cavity quantum electrodynamics, cavity QD for short. And then I'll explain what we now call circuit quantum electrodynamics. And I'll tell you in this setting, what in this realization, what are the artificial atoms and cavities that we use, and what are the advantages. And then I'll show some of the recent experimental results obtained by my colleagues. And we'll see that when analyzing this system, we can understand in quite some detail these experimental results. And for example, pick up signature of measurement-induced dephasing or measurement back action in the system, in the electrical system. And also, we'll see that we can extract, when looking at time domain experiments, we can extract much more information in these from these experiments than the other groups have been able to. For example, we'll solve at least for this particular architecture the long-standing problem of wide radiations at small amplitudes. So we'll see that here, that we understand this in quite some detail. So first, quantum electrodynamics. So here the aim is to study the interaction of an atom shown via this green circle in this cartoon. So we take this atom as a simple two-level system, and we like to study the interaction of this atom with a single photon. This is done by placing the atom in an optical cavity, for example, shown in this cartoon by these two blue regions which represent high-quality unipolished mirrors. And so you place the atom in this cavity, and if the atom and the resonator and the cavity, I'm sorry, at the same frequency, the transition frequency of this guy and the transition frequency of the atom, if they're close, then the atom will start interacting with that particular mode, which is at that particular frequency. And that will lead to some non-trivial interaction, which can be described by the James-Cumming Hamiltonian. So this, for starting, represents the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian for the cavity. So omega r is the mode of the cavity with which we will be working, and a and a dagger create and eliminate a single photon at that particular frequency. That's the Hamiltonian describing our two-level atom, where omega a is the transition frequency. And this is a very important term, the James-Cumming interaction, which describes exchange of a single quantum between field and atom. So we create a photon by destroying, if you will, the state of the atom and vice versa. And that occurs at the rate g. So g is an important time scale, setting the rate at which the quantum dynamics will occur. There's another important time scale in this problem, kappa, which describes the photon leakage rate. So these mirrors are not perfect, and photons will just leak through. So we lost energy there. Also, we're not working with a completely closed 4-pi cavity. So the atom can emit two modes which are not sustained by the cavity, and that leads to this gamma, this spontaneous emission rate, for the atom to go from the excited to the ground state. And that occurs at the rate of gamma. Another important time scale is the transit time. These atoms are just falling down to the cavity, to the influence of gravity. And they interact with the mole just for a very short time, called the transit time. And so the really interesting regime for kinetic quantum microdynamics or kinetic QED is the strong coupling regime, where G, the interaction rate, is much bigger than all the dissipative rates or this transit rate, which is this time, which can be thought of as a dissipative rate also. And so when this is realized, then the energy will be exchanged between the atom and the field for several cycles before dissipation kicks in and reloads the quantum effects. And realizing this strong coupling regime in practice has taken several decades in quantum optics, but now has been realized for the first time about 10 years ago. So a few more words about cavity quantum electrodynamics and this Hamiltonian. Let's take a situation where the atom is tuned in resonance with the resonator. So the detuning parameter, which is defined as the difference between these two frequencies, equal to zero here. In this situation, I can draw the energy diagram of my system in the following way. Well, first I have two states for my atom, the ground and the excited. And associated to these different possible states for the atom, I have different possible numbers of photons inside the cavity. And that leads to these two dressed bare ladders of states describing the uncoupled cavity atom system. In the case where delta equals zero, then these levels are degenerate. Okay, but of course, the finite coupling will lift the degeneracy. And the degeneracy is lifted by 2g for the first doublet, and more generally, it scales as the square root of m, the average photon number inside. Okay. So these blue states, I'll refer to them as the dressed James Cumming states. Okay. So one way to probe the spectrum and make sure that yes, we indeed have this coupling is shown in this cartoon. So these are the two mirrors forming the cavity. You have the cloud of atoms that you release, and eventually there will be one or some number of atoms inside the cavity. And you probe the system by shining a laser through the cavity and looking at the amplitude of the transmitted signal at the end. So this is a typical experiment done, for example, by Jeff Kimball at Caltech. And so what they do in this experiment is they look at the transmission amplitude as a function of probe frequency. And they prepare the system in its combined ground state. If there was no atom, if there was no coupling, the only thing they would see is this first this transition. So we would see a single peak at the resonator frequency. Although, of course, in the presence of the coupling, there's no longer any level at that energy. What they have is a doublet. And so if they probe the system at weak power, tuning the frequency, what they need to see is this doublet, which is a signature of these first excited states. So this is really a proof that the strong coupling regime was achieved. Because if coupling was not bigger than the dissipation rate, then the separation would not be bigger than the width, and these doublets would not be resolvable.
Can you say something about how you would, what the obstacles are in achieving the regime?
I mean, I'll answer that question by explaining our suggestion, and that suggestion addresses these problems. So I'll answer these questions as we go. But if you feel that you didn't get this answer, yes, please. So what we suggested a year and a half ago, roughly, is what we call now circuit quantum electrodynamics. So what we suggested is to replace the optical cavity by a superconducting wave-kind resonator, and we suggested to replace the atom by an artificial atom, shown in green in this cartoon. So we could use several types of artificial atoms. We decided to work with superconducting charged qubit. So I'll say a few words about the cavity, the artificial atom, and then say how can be coupled strongly. So this transmission line resonator is really, in a sense, a 1D coaxial cable. The same type of cable that we plug into our TV to get the signal. as a shield, which is put to ground, as a center pin conductor, where we apply the voltage. And so this cartoon here, this resonator, has two ground planes, which are like the shield of our coax cable, and a center pin, which is this line here. Of course, here you notice that we have two gaps. And these two gaps that we've made in this 1D system define a length of the resonator, therefore a wavelength where the system will transmit best. And so this is in this way that this acts as a resonator. These two gaps, in a sense, act as the two mirrors in our optical cavity. So this is how it looks in practice. So this is an optical picture taken by my instrumental colleagues. So this is a centimeter size. A device. Green is the substrate, and gray is a thin film of niobium of superconductor forming the resonator. And so the region below the white line is one ground plane. The region above the white line is another ground plane. This is the input port. This is the output port. And if we zoom in, so we see again the ground planes, this center pin, which has this funny gap here. And if you zoom in on the right gradient, you would also see this funny gap, which defines the length of the system. And so they can study the system by shining microwaves at the input port and looking at the transmission at the output. And what they see is a nice Lorentzian shape spectrum with the transition frequency here centered at 6 GHz. And from the width, they get a quantity factor of 10 to the 4 at 20 nanometers. They can also look at the phase of the transmitted signal with respect to incoming signal, and what they see is the standard 5 phase shift across resonance. And so from these numbers, you can extract the equivalent of kappa in this system. Kappa is related to the frequency in Q, and is of the order of the megahertz here. So this means that a photon will live typically for a few hundred nanoseconds inside this system, so quite long photon lifetimes. And it's important to point out that Q or kappa are not limited by losses in the niobium. These are sporadic systems, and there's almost no dissipation. The kappa and Q are really limited by this coupling to the input and output leads. And also another point to mention is that we're using high frequency resonators, and this high frequency 6 GHz corresponds roughly to 300 millikelvin temperature scale. And that means that if you cool down the system to low enough temperature and ask what's the thermal population of this system, you will see that it's pretty much zero. This means that we can prepare the system in its quantum mechanical ground state, just by cooling it, just doing nothing. And that turns out to be extremely important for the rest. Okay, so if we work with this single resonance that I showed in the previous slide, then for all practical purposes, this big centimeter long resonator looks pretty much like an LC circuit. And this is the third model that I'll use for the rest of the talk. So I have an LC circuit with a well-defined resonance at a frequency omega r, which corresponds to the transmission frequency of that guy. And so I can write down, of course, the Hamiltonian of my LC circuit by quantizing its electrical circuit. And I can ask, okay, so I can prepare the system in a ground state. What are the properties of this of a simple harmonic oscillator in the ground state? Well, first, the expectation of the value of the voltage across this LC circuit, equivalent of the expectation value of the position for a mechanical oscillator, is just zero. But there is zero-point motion fluctuations here. And so there's a non-zero RMS value of the voltage, even in the ground state. And the scale for this voltage, for this quantum fluctuation of the voltage, is given by is roughly a microvolt for these frequencies we are using. And then if you notice that the separation between, so I have a microvolt of voltage across this LC circuit is RMS, or equivalent to have this voltage on the center pin. And the separation between the center pin and the ground plane, something I call B here, is of the order of the micrometer. This means that the electric field in this region of the circuit is a large fraction of a volt per meter. And that answers part of your question. A great advantage here is that the electric field is huge. This is actually a huge electric field, orders of magnitude. The electric field that one could obtain in a typical 3D cavity, which are used for these types of experiments. This is due to the fact that we have an extremely low mode volume. We're using a 1D cavity. This is the smallest you can make it, so the electric field will be big. And now we go about and put a qubit inside the system, and the qubit will couple to this field, and therefore will couple strongly to the to the RNA that's here, and that should lead to the strong coupling regime. So this is how it looks in practice. So again, there is a 30 centimeter long, the input port, output port, and if you zoom in on a smaller region, you see that they have fabricated a supermelting charge qubit shown in blue. So this supermelting charge qubit is a Cooper pair of bugs. So that's another name for these circuits. And there's a lot that could be said about these circuits in a talk, and I could give a talk just on these circuits. But the main point to know that you have to keep from this slide is that these systems are artificial electrical two-level systems, and they are controllable, fully controllable using two knobs, flux and voltage. So in a bit more words, so the main ingredient in a Cooper pair box is a supergravitating island, a small grain of superconductor, shown in green here, which is capacitively connected to a gate voltage, and is which is connected to a reservoir or a bigger piece of superconductor through these Josephson junctions, these little X here. And those Josephson junctions allow for coherent tunneling of Cooper pair in and out of the island. So now that I have my circuit, I can write down an Hamiltonian for the circuit, and I can calculate the energy of this grain of superconductor as a function of the voltage which I apply, or equivalently the gate charge, which is just proportional to the voltage. And this is what I find. I find so a ground state, this second band, which is a first excited state, and all other excited states above are well separated and can be ignored for all practical purposes. So I can now truncate the Hilbert space of this electrical circuit down to two levels and have a complete quantum description of this system. Now that I've done this truncation of the Hilbert space, I can write down an effective Hamiltonian for this system, which is, of course, the Hamiltonian of a pseudo spin 1/2 in an effective field. The effective field will have two contributions, one along a direction that I call z, and that's the effective field direction is related to the fluorescent energy, the tunneling matrix element for Cooper pair. And I have a contribution in the direction that I call x, which is related to the electrostatic energy. How much energy does it cost to have an extra Cooper pair on this side? And these two effective fields are tunable. The Josephson energy I can change by applying a flux, changing a magnetic field of this loop. And the electrostatic energy I can change by changing the gate charge or equivalent to the voltage on this island. So again, two-level system, two knobs, voltage and flux. And with that, I can control all the parameters of my system. So now my experimental colleagues go around and fabricate one of these qubits inside the resonator. So again, this is the ground plane. In green, the substrate. This is the center pin. And in blue, the qubit. So this straight line is the island I was referring to. These two little dots here are the two junctions, and that's the loop to which they can apply a flux. They can also apply a voltage from the outside. So there's a DC voltage which will just bias the system. But now more importantly, this island is capacitively coupled to this center pin. So if I go back to my toy model, I've capacitively coupled my qubit to the LC circuit. And now the qubit will feel the RMS value, the strong RMS value of the voltage across this LC circuit. And I need to take that into account in my description of the voltage which the qubit sees. So now I can plug in this expression for the voltage in the expression that I add for my political system in Newtonia, and out of that I get the following result. So I get the James Cumming Hamiltonian that I described at the beginning of the talk. So I've mapped this centimeters long electrical circuit down to something which is traditionally studying a completely different field of physics, something which is studying quantum optics. And so there are advantages of this of studying this James Cumming dynamics in this solid state context. One of them is that G here can be huge. The coupling can be large, and this is what we want. We want the biggest coupling possible. G depends on this ratio of capacitance. Cg is the gate capacitance. C sigma is the total capacitance of this little island, times the RMS value of the voltage, which is across the LC circuit. And all of these parameters, they can be controlled at fabrication times. And the constraints on them are such that G can be tuned between 1 and actually several hundreds of megahertz. And if you remember that kappa here was 1 megahertz, And as it turns out, gamma, the atom decay rate, will also be a megahertz. And this means that the strong coupling regime can really be achieved. Also, another advantage, which comes back to your previous question, the transit time here is physically infinite. The system is glued on the chip, and it's not going anywhere. It's not falling down into the cavity as in the optical case. And therefore, we have all the time to study this J-scaling dynamics. That's a great advantage, in fact.
Just I think I missed the point of how you get rid of semantics.
Yeah, that's a good point. So actually, here I've hidden under the rug the fact that I've chosen a special value for the DC part. And the sigma x actually has the remnant of the sigma x part in this minus and plus here. But I've coupled sigma x to the voltage. The voltage is described by A that here. Now I get this effective interaction. Yes, it is. So I've chosen some special, actually here we choose some special symmetry points for the system when the system is one stable. And there's a lot behind this that I want to go into in this stuff. So now that we've done this mapping, and we're confident that it's a good map, we're confident that it's a good mapping describing the system, we'd like to check, is there any experimental signature that our experimental colleagues get? An experiment that we can do which will prove that indeed that's the correct description. And what we can do is look for the vacuum remistivity, these two peaks that I've shown previously in the talk. So what they do is they shine microwave at the input port of the resonator and look at the transmitted signal at the output, and they vary the frequency of that probe. First, they need to adjust the resonator frequency with the qubit frequency by choosing the proper voltage and flux. And so that's if they tune everything correctly, they should have this first doublet. So again, look at transmission as a function of frequency. And so if there was no doublets here, you would only see this first this frequency, which is shown in this dashed line. But now in the presence of the qubit end coupling, what we see are two extremely well-defined peaks. So from the theory, we can extract all the relevant parameters, G, kappa, and gamma. And we see that G is roughly six times bigger than kappa and gamma, which is a confirmation that the strong coupling, or actually very strong coupling regime of Kennedy QE was achieved. So that was actually the first observation of this kind of physics in a solid state device at the level of a single photon and a single atom, single artificial atom. And so now that we have this mapping, we're ready to explore more quantum optics I can suggest more experiments to my experimental colleagues and study more interesting physics, either in quantum optics or eventually start thinking about quantum information processing. And the relevant regime to do that is the dispersive regime, or dispersive limit. And that limit, delta, the detuning, which is the difference again between atom transition frequency and resonator, we take to be much bigger than the coupling. So in this case, although we're still in a strong coupling regime, there's an energy mismatch between qubit and resonator, and therefore energy exchange between the two is very difficult. And so in that situation, we can replace the J-scaling Hamiltonian by this effective Hamiltonian, which is valid to second order in G over delta, where G over delta is a small parameter. So in that new effective Hamiltonian, what we have is omega, we have the previous term that we had seen before, omega r times a layer a, the resonator Hamiltonian, omega a times sigma z, the two-level system Hamiltonian, and now we have these two terms which are different. This last one can be interpreted as a land shift, a shift of the qubit transition frequency due to vacuum fluctuations in the cavity. And this term, which is very important, can be interpreted as a cavity pull, a change of the cavity frequency due to the presence of the atom. And indeed, in the system, the resonator frequency is no longer omega r, but it's omega r plus or minus g squared over delta, depending on the state of the qubit. So if you do a transmission experiment, you look at transmission as a function of frequency, you don't expect to see a peak at the bare resonator frequency. You expect to see a peak which is either full to the left or to the right, depending on the state of the qubit. And so now we have a simple, and actually something that my experimental colleagues can measure very easily, the simple property of the resonator, which depends on the state of the qubit. And this is what we're going to use here to read out the atomic state or read out the qubit state. So there are different ways to do that, but what we propose is to shine microwave at the input point of the resonator, still now at the bare resonator frequency. And now, instead of looking at the amplitude of the transmitted signal, we will look at the phase of the transmitted signal with respect to the incoming phase. So like the line measurement work, those who are expert in that. So this is a plot of the phase as a function of frequency. The dashed line, I put again the transmission peak, and on top of this dashed line, the corresponding phase shift, something that I actually presented earlier. So if we sit at that variable frequency, we see that a large negative phase shift, the blue line, corresponds to the qubit in its ground state, and a large positive phase shift, the red line, corresponds to the qubit in its excited state. So the ability to distinguish between these two phase values is equivalent to the ability to distinguish, to read out the state of the qubit. In practice, the separation between these two peaks might not be so big that these two S-looking curves are well separated, and the difference in phase shift might be smaller. And so more generally, it will be given that this, by this expression, yes.
So in the previous data that you showed, right, it was pretty much in resonance, right?
Yes.
So that was a proof and the principle that the device works and you can interact with. So is the idea here behind that by working away from the resonance, you can encode the qubit by adding the frequency point?
Yes. So let me, that's a great question to show a nice, oops. I'll show you some more data actually to answer that.
And I guess the second question is that you're not going to lose this the differentiation in the frequency pulling by going beyond G squared with alpha.
No.
Okay.
No. Okay. There's no problem there. Of course, this G squared with alpha is really an approximation, but it's a good approximation. So this is a full plot which answers part of your question. So this is, again, the vacuum value splitting. But now, so the color scale is the amplitude. The frequency, so what I've shown before was a line cut here. So we see a peak, a second peak. That's the two doublets. But now they also scan the gate charge. Okay, and so they go away from resonance. And what you see, so these dashed lines are the unperturbed state, the full line of the perturbed state. And you see that, okay, so at far close from resonance, there's a huge shift. Okay, but still far from resonance, there's quite an noticeable shift. And that's the shift that they measure to read out the state of the qubit. Okay. So as I was saying, in practice, the pull won't be so large that the phase shift will go from plus 90 to minus 90. And it will be given by this expression, so twice the pull time 1 over kappa, where 1 over kappa is just a photon lifetime. And also, it's interesting to point out that this is a QND measurement. It's a measurement, for quantum non-dimensional measurement, which means that since the effective Hamiltonian is Hamiltonian from use with sigma z is a constant of motion. The act of measuring sigma z doesn't change sigma z. Doesn't change the measurement result. And that's exactly what this causes, only dephasing as a good measurement should. Okay, so how does it work in practice? And does it work at other times? So here I show in orange the transition frequency of this artificial atom, my qubit, as a function of the applied gate charge. And in blue, the bare resonator frequency, which does not depend on gate charge. And now they apply a measurement of frequency, a beam at that particular frequency, at the bare resonator frequency, and they measure the phase of the transmitted signal with respect to the incoming signal. And what they see is this phase as a function of charge, and they see this bump in the response. And so they see a maximum response when the detuning is smallest, as small response, almost no phase shift, when the detuning is largest. Exactly what we expect from a 1 over detuning relation. And actually, the detailed shape here corresponds to exactly what we expect from the effective interplay. But that result only applies to the ground state. This is a steady state measure only. The system was cooled down to its ground state and they measured for a long time. And so if the qubit was rather in its excited state, we would just we'd expect to see a dip, another bump, just a mirror image, just a sign change in the response. And so we need to verify that. One way is to perturb, to excite the qubit up to the excited, up to its higher energy state. And the way to do that is to just to add a signal frequency to the system. And we chose this frequency such that it's in resonance with the qubit at this particular gate charge. So if the blue line corresponds to the qubit in its ground state, the red the qubit in its excited state, at that particular value of the gate charge, the qubit is mixed, its state is changed due to the presence of this spectroscopy beam. And if we look over long times, and if the spectroscopy beam is high power enough, then this will just incrementally mix the two states of the qubit. There's no coherence superposition left here. And what we should therefore see is just the average between these two results, something which goes to zero as we crank up the spectroscopy power. And this is indeed what they see. OK, so the measurement dispersive readout does work as advertised. OK. So now let's look at something a bit different. We will fix the gate charge at this point in G equal 1. And now we'll change the frequency of the spectroscopy. And we'll see through that we can see directly the effect of the measurement on the qubit, or the back action of the measurement. So what they do here is they measure the phase shift, fixed gate charge, and they change the frequency. In this situation, they look at the spectrum of the qubit, the response of the qubit at these different frequencies. And so what they see is a Lorentzian shape response. And going from this panel to the other, what they've done is that they keep the spectroscopy power constant, but they change the readout power. They're putting more photons to read out the system, measuring RU and RU. And there's two things that you see, a shift of the qubit transition frequency and a broadening also. So these are the two effects that we need to understand. Well, the shift is easy to understand. This shift is easy. We just look at this effective Hamiltonian and just concentrate on this term, and I'll just rewrite this Hamiltonian by putting this term down in this other parenthesis. So now this term, which initially I described as a heavy pool, now I can interpret as a change of the qubit transition frequency due to the photon, which depends on the photon number. This is just a classic AC strike shift. So if I plot this effective qubit transition frequency as a function of photon number, I should just see a straight line. And indeed, if you plot the peak position as a function of measurement power or frequency, again, photon number, you recover this straight line. So that was easy. Now what we need to understand is this broadening. Where does it come from? And we'll see also that comes from this term, actually. So here I plot the half width at half maximum as a function of the photon number as you increase the measurement power. And what you see is an increase which is initially linear in n, and eventually it wants to bend to a square root of n dependence. And from the NMR literature, we know that this half width at half max is related to the dephasing in the system. So what we see is that as we measure with more intensity the system, it dephases faster. So the way to understand that is, again, to look at this effective Hamiltonian. So this DC part of this Hamiltonian gave us the strike shift, just the shift in the qubit's position of the qubit spectrum. But there will be fluctuation in this term due to the finite dissipation. I have a finite quality cavity, photon number will fluctuate. And I need to take into account this, these fluctuations. Very fast, starting from a superposition of state, I have a qubit which is starting a superposition up and down. What is the phase that is accumulated under evolution with this Hamiltonian? And of course, quantum mechanics tells me that, well, the phase will have a contribution to this transition frequency, which is lamb shifted. And now I have a contribution, which I call phi of t, due to this term. This contribution, phi of t, I can write as the sum of two terms, a mean, plus a fluctuation around the mean. Okay? Just rewriting this term. So that's the mean. Basically the expectation value of theta equal a, just gave me the AC star shift, the shift of the spectroscopic line. But this term is a random term and will therefore cause rephasing. We know that in these systems, it's fluctuations, so frequency fluctuations in the transition frequency, which is the cause of rephasing. And this is exactly what we have here. So if I want to calculate the effect of this this noise, I need to calculate the off-diagonal matrix element for the reduced density matrix of the qubit. Or equivalently, I have to calculate the reduction of this exponential in time. So the expectation value of this exponential is basically how much does this term here, which describes Fourier length between up and down, goes down in time. And that term has information about the phasing. So assuming to start with Gaussian fluctuation, I can stop at this, I can do this kinetic expansion. And what I see is that I need to calculate this photon-photon number correlation function. And that photon-photon number correlation function will depend on dissipation, will decay with kappa, the photon decay time. And so now that I have this expression, I can go ahead and calculate my dephasing time. Actually, here I'm not interested in a real time experiment. We're looking at spectroscopy, so a frequency domain experiment. But I'm really interested in the Fourier transform, the spectral information, which is something in that term. So I can calculate the spectrum of the qubit. I can do that exactly in that particular case. And what I find is that the spectrum is a sum of Lorentzians. And each Lorentzians are weighted by this interesting factor. This gamma measurement is the measurement rate. It's the rate at which I acquire information about the system. This rate scales as a photon number, because surely as I put more photon in the system, I must acquire information faster, because the photons are what I measure. And so now I can.
So what's the gamma 2?
Gamma 2, yes, thank you. This term is actually the only adjustable parameter in the theory, and that's what sets the intrinsic dephasing rate of the system. There's some intrinsic rate. On top of that, I'm measuring the system, which is causing extra dephasing. This intrinsic rate, you can measure independently, for example, by doing Ramsey fringe experiments or other type of experiments. This is the only adjustable parameter in the theory. So if I calculate this dephasing time or rate as a function of photon number from this theory, this is what I get. So the argument is pretty good, given the fact that there's a single adjustable parameter. And this adjustable parameter, the only thing it does is shift vertically this whole curve, depending on the intrinsic dephasing rate. And there's some extra dephasing in the experiment, but that's to be expected. And so the physics here is that at low photon number, it takes a long time to measure the state of the qubit. It actually takes several photon lifetimes to measure the system. So the system just randomly goes through a random walk, and the phase just accumulates randomly. And I therefore get something which is dephasing rate which scales as n. And actually, I now realize that I forgot to mention something in the previous slide. And that thing I forgot to mention is that something that they do observe experimentally is that as they increase the photon number, the line shape is initially Lorentzian, fits the Lorentz shape. And at higher photon number, it wants to fit to a Gaussian much better than to a Lorentzian. And so that. The expression that I just presented has that built in. At low photon number, the measurement rate is quite small. Therefore, only a few factors here will contribute, which will lead to a Lorentzian, which will lead to a Lorentzian line shape. At a higher photon number, this rate is large, so this the rate can be measurement rate can be much bigger than the dissipation rate, and therefore many such terms will contribute, and some of Lorentz theorem will give me a Gaussian, and that explains this crossover. And in NMR term, what I have is a crossover between homogeneous Brownian to inhomogeneous Brownian at higher photon number. Okay. So now let me switch gear and talk about coordinately controlling the state of this artificial atom. So now the idea is, instead of sending both the measurement beam and the spectroscopy beam, and both of them during for the full length of the experiment, what they do is the following thing. They first start shining a weak measurement beam at time t equals zero, just like the blue region, and then eventually they start a sharp pulse, the spectroscopy beam, which is at the transition frequency of the qubit. And that beam should pump the system to, for example, to its excited state, or it should at least be, we should be able to do some radiations using this the spectroscopy beam. And so what they measure with the qubit starting in about state, so shown by the represented by the subpole of the block sphere. So here, what they measure is the phase shift as a function of time. So initially, what they see is this the phase shift which corresponds to exactly what we expect if the qubit was in its ground state, exactly what we expect from here. And this, I should point out that this upper dashed line corresponds to what we expect if the qubit was in its excited state and staying there for a long time. And so now they shine the spectroscopy beam, which for some height and width could correspond, for example, to a pi phase shift. And so what they measure now, what they should measure now is a change in the phase shift, because the cavity frequency has been pulled. And the cavity frequency has been pulled on a time scale which is extremely short. This pulse here is of the order of the nanosecond, much smaller than this landscape. But there's a problem here. It's because we're using high quality resonators, it takes some time for the photons to leak out and inform us about this phase shift. And so instead of seeing a sharp rise, a jump in the phase, what they see is an exponential rise of the phase over time. But while the phase is rising, the qubit is already decaying down due to T1 processes. So what we see is a competition between an exponential rise and an exponential fall. And so that's why we don't reach this naively expected result. And so we can write down a theoretical model here, an analytical result model for this, which is this red curve. This is not a fifth theory, but really an analytical result, which has a single adjustable parameter again, which is this T1 time. So it just sets the scale for this decay. And we get this model by starting with the effective Hamiltonian and adding dissipation, adding drive. And we then have to derive some kind of block equations for the qubit. But now we have to take into account the fact that we have a cavity, and there is a dissipation of that cavity. And so that leads to some subtleties, but in the end, we can get an expression which fits very nicely with the experiment.
Is this T1 half of the T2?
No. T1 is 8 microseconds here. It's long. It's not T2.
Can you remind us of what T2?
I didn't give T2, but T2 is of the order of 500 nanoseconds. I mean, I gave T2, but not the. I gave T2 on the measurement, not the pure T2 without the measurement direction. They did Ramsey experiments to expect.
I remember which. So T1 is decaying.
T1 is relaxation, energy relaxation going from ground to down to excited. T2 is phase, you're losing phase information. That's this slow fluctuation like time. Okay, so now they can, of course, keep the pulse height constant and change the width, and it can do 2 pi pulses, 3 pi pulses, and so on. And from that, now we can extract what we call the contrast. That's an important quantity. The contrast is defined as the ratio between the observed swing in the measurement response over the total expected response. And here we get a contrast of 85%, which is actually much bigger than all the other supernatant qubit groups have obtained so far. But we think that we can do better. We think that we can do better than this 35% contrast. Basically, because we have this detailed understanding of the time response of the measurement. So here, what I show is the full data, full and processed data. So the time for the same axis here, but here the vertical axis is a pulse width. We're changing the pulse width, and the color scale represents the measured phase. So blue, negative phase shift or ground state; red, positive phase shift or excited state. So for example, these line cuts corresponds to pi poles, pi, 2 pi, and 3 pi poles, which are two of them are being shown here. So if you take a line cut here and you follow the state of the qubit as you change the pulse width, what you see is the association of the probability of the qubit to go up and down, or being in the excited states, goes up and down. So if we were to plot this raw data, what we see is the association going from these two extremums. So we'd see a contrast of 85% in our radiations. But we can do better. And actually, what we want to plot is not really the contrast and measure the best ones. What we're really interested in when we do radiation is what was the actual state of the qubit after that given pulse. So we're interested in the qubit population, not only the phase. The problem, although it's going from contrast to the actual qubit response, is that the contrast is a convolution of several effects. There's relaxation, qubit is relaxing, and that changes this contrast. There's finite readout time, as I mentioned. And there could be also imperfections of the readout. And the pulse might not have been perfect, actually. It could have done a small fraction pulse instead of a 3-5 pulse. But now we have this theoretical model which knows about relaxation, it knows about readout time. The thing it assumes is, well, the pulse was perfect. You give that pulse length, you get that result. And so by doing a detailed comparison between the red and the blue curve for all of these data points, now we can extract the pulse fidelity. And this is what we get. So we get radiations which, as they should, scale from pretty much 0 to 100%, exactly as you would predict from quantum mechanics. And it's really the first time that such large visibility in the radiation has been observed. And understanding this why in most experiments the visibility is low has really been one of the main challenges in these supercritical qubits. But now we have this simple, this very good agreement between this model and this experiment. So we understand this problem, at least for this architecture.
I found that you're saying that the pulse imperfection of the pulse is minimal.
Minimal. Yes.
So this is a picture of factoring out the readout and the derivative.
Yes. Yeah. So basically, we maybe assess, go back in time and say, okay, if there was no dissipation, then, well. Okay. So that completes what I wanted to say today. So in summary, so we suggested to use supernothing, what the wave cry resonators, as artificial cavities to recreate proper conditions to observe quantum 3D in solid state device. And the real key here was that our cavity had huge vacuum fields and still have long photon times, long enough that we can observe these interesting quantum mechanical effects. We suggested to use a superconducting charge qubit, which have long coherence times. And the interaction between these two should be strong, and indeed, this was observed for the first time by the group of Rodchokov, where they observed this vacuum ready splitting. And as a bonus to this architecture, we have a very well characterized and non destructive readout mechanism to extract information about the state of the qubit. And because of this piercing and QND and dispersive readout, we could understand back action, measurement back action on this electrical circuit, and also for the first time extract large visibility in value associations. And there are several things that we would like to do in the future from two-qubit gates, of course, just putting a single qubit inside, to solve more quantum optics, or even potentially more quantum information related experiments. So thank you for your attention.
One thing is the following fact of the resonator.
This is a
10 to the 4,
but it's an overcoupled resonator. So if you undercouple it, the Q is not limited by dissipation. It's really limited by the coupling. And so if you minimize the coupling, which just means having less capacitance here, but having these funny fingers,
right,
you get up to 10 to the 6.
Was there a reason to do it? What's the reason to do it this way?
With low Q, well, low end, your Q on purpose. Just one pass without time. You see this exponential rise and exponential decay. If we had lower Q qualities, then we would not only the visibility, but the contrast would be 100%. So it's a trade off between long photon lifetime and fast response. So there's no winning any money, you have to lose some money.
Could you do a quick comparison between what you can achieve with these systems versus what you can achieve with real QD cavities and real atoms?
Yes. Well, something that I'd like to show. Let's first the difference, just remind the difference between this curve and this curve, which is already a good look at the separation and the peak separation. So the coupling is much stronger. The coupling defined as with respect to the ratio of the coupling with kappa and gamma is much stronger here than what we can achieve. A crucial advantage, actually, really the crucial advantage why this work is that the qubit is glued on the chip. Mm-hmm. So in this cavity, the atom, first they don't really know how many atoms they have. They now have some techniques to address that, but they need to first figure out, okay, how many atoms do I have? And then the atoms will fall down. And when they are in the cavity, there's this strong, intense transverse